I'm going to introduce a very familiar face to most of us who've been around for a while. Emil Stipp is an actuary, health actuary, discovery. I think he wears many hats. He says he's going to tell you a bit more about himself, but he didn't give me his formal bio, so I can introduce him how I want. And when he comes on, you should ask him what the average person is. Then you will know Emil Stipp. Emil?
So thank you very much, Alton. It is great to be here in person. Great to see everybody. Also nice to be able to have welcome more people online. So I was asked, thanks very much for that introduction, and I was asked to talk about AI and particularly about international developments in that. What I would like to do is to have a somewhat more informal presentation and also just to get some of your questions and thoughts on it. I do think that we are at a sort of watershed moment when it comes to the use of data science, not only in healthcare but in the world. And I'd like to tell you just a little bit about our sort of high-level philosophy on what the next frontiers are in data science and how we should be thinking about it. It is based on the work that we're doing in the UK and in South Africa. So as Shelton says, I do wear a few hats. I split my time now between here and London, and I head up data science and actuarial function in the UK, and I'm still involved also in South Africa in data science and actuarial function, amongst a few other things. But I think it has been fascinating to see both during COVID and, even before then, how things are starting to change around us. There's more data available. There's more contestation about who gets to see that data. And obviously, if one wants people to share that data with you, you have to give them a reason. With Vitality, we're quite lucky in Discovery that we do have the ability to give people that reason because they get some advantage out of it. They get some rewards. And with that, there's actually a lot that we can tell about human behavior and how that plays out in the data. So I think I'd like to just share two high-level thoughts with you. The first one is the importance of perspective, and the second one is really correlation and causation, and just talk about some of the details around that. But I thought to take a little bit of a different approach and not to throw at you lots of models with lots of sort of results that we're finding, but really to take something quite unusual to an actuarial conference, I think, which is art. But when you think about perspective, that's obviously something that's quite important in art. And if you do go to London, this is one of the most famous paintings in the world. It's a bar at the Folies Bergère, painted by Edouard Manet in 1882. It's a famous painting, and it also hangs in the Courtauld Institute in London. So if you ever have a chance to see it, it is actually an amazing painting to see in real life. But if you look at this painting, it does have an unusual perspective, right? The first thing that you notice is obviously the central figure, the woman standing there looking at you. She's front and center in the painting, and behind her there's a mirror reflecting back on the room. Now, this bar was one of the favorite places for Manet to go to, but he painted this in the last year of his life. But the striking thing about this painting, if you look at it, is the expression on the central character's face, right? And the key thing there is that she's not looking at the viewer. She's looking elsewhere, as if she's lost in thought. There are a few other things. There's a lot of details in this painting. So there's, if you look at the top right-hand corner, let's see if this works. Yeah, over there, you can see a trapeze artist, just their legs hanging down. She's reflected in the mirror. If you do look for it, there's a lot of triangles in the painting on these two beer bottles. That's, by the way, the first logo ever created in the world was on this beer bottle that's in here. But there's also triangles there, for instance, that woman's arms. There's another triangle right there. If we have a beer, I can tell you what it means, but I won't say what it means now. But there's a symbol there. But the important thing is, if you look at it, and I wonder how many of you noticed it, in the mirror there's reflected another person, who's not painted, right? That person is talking to the woman looking at us or not looking at us, and that person is the painter himself, obviously not in the painting because he's talking to her. Now, if you think about the interpretation of that in the context of this being his last year of life, there's a whole lot of things that you can say about it from an art historical perspective. But the important thing is that if you really look at the perspective and what it means, you get quite a different sense of the world. There's a lot of data in this painting, but the perspective that you have on it, I think, is really important. So by paying attention to the perspective, you gain richer and greater insights into the world. It's not only about having lots of data, but also how you interpret it. Here's just for fun another painting, also quite a famous one. It looks completely ordinary. It's a still life of a bowl with some vegetables in it. What's fascinating about this was painted in 1587 by an Italian painter, Arcimboldo, and it just looks like a normal still life until you turn it around. And then you see something different in it. Now, I have shown this to an actuarial audience before, and some people came to me afterwards and said, what's with the upside-down bowl of vegetables? So, quite a few people apparently did not see the face. So if you wanted them, I'd love to meet you because I'd like to understand how your brain works. But for me, it's very obvious that those are the cheeks, those are the lips, there's a nose, and there's two eyes there, even though it's a carrot and the mushrooms, etc. So sometimes you have to look at things from different angles. Now, the first thing that is becoming more and more important, I think, in perspective, is that when you apply a huge amount of data to a problem, I think it's not good enough anymore to say that a model is an AI model, it's a neural net, it's predicting a particular result, but we can't tell why it's predicting a particular result. I think the perspective that we need as health actuaries is always to understand the why. And the good news is that it's possible to do that. So whenever we run neural nets or any sort of model that becomes hard to interpret, what's now become standard practice is that we always do a variable importance plot, and we use a SHAP algorithm to do so. So this basically reruns the models, but for every individual that's in the data, and it re-predicts it for that person, and then says why it's predicting a particular result for that person. So you can always understand why your neural net is predicting that this person is at risk of diabetes within 3 years, or this person will have a bad COVID outcome. And obviously there's a lot of variables that goes into it, and you can see whether it predicts a better or worse result depending on the shading. And on top of that, partial dependence plots are really important to understand the shape of that prediction for each one of the variables that's in the model. So I think, you know, in terms of the use of AI, we had lots of debates with the UK regulator on this. The big fear from a regulator's perspective is, well, you can't tell why a model is predicting something, and hence there might be inherent bias within your models, and you won't be able to understand it, and they're worried about it. So what we explained to them is that actually it doesn't need to be that case. You can actually tell why a model is predicting something if you do explainable AI. And these tools are available. It's not the only ones. There are some others as well. LIME is another one that you can use, but it basically tells you why the model is predicting that. And then you can evaluate whether there's any bias in there. But the second point that we're making is to say that actually it's not that clear to me that a machine would naturally or necessarily have more bias than human decision makers, okay? Because everybody has bias. And I think, you know, when one looks at data and how it's predicting, you have to understand what it's doing, but it's still a human that needs to decide to apply the data in a particular way with a particular perspective to a particular problem. So I think the important thing getting the right perspective is firstly, obviously, to have a lot of data available. The more you have, the more insight you can gain. To use the tools of explainable AI, as soon as you take a lot of data through a model, it means that it becomes more opaque, and hence it's important to explain it and to be able to explain it, and then to have talented multidisciplinary teams in order to interpret all of this. So we'll talk a little bit more about all of these principles by looking at correlation versus causation. Now, I think this is a very important topic because I think it has been mistreated in a lot of data science for many years, and I think If we carry on with the traditional approach of data science, it's actually a major missed opportunity for healthcare in particular. Just because our work involves so much interventionist thought. So, for instance, should we pay for a particular treatment? That depends on how effective it is. That's effectively a causal question. Should we say that people should be going to a different network of providers, and how can we tell that the quality of healthcare is still adequate, even if they do? Again, that's a causal question. If they now go to different doctors, do they get different outcomes? Is it because of the doctor or because of something else? For you to understand that, I think you need to understand causality quite a lot, or in quite a lot of detail. But obviously, all of us went through statistics. The first thing we told when we go through statistics that correlation does not imply causation. That's true, so I thought I'll give you an example of that. This is a picture of pure genius. It's Beethoven. You can look at him, and then you can compare him against this picture, which is me after 4 months of not cutting my hair during lockdown in London. And obviously you can see that having a lot of hair is strongly causal when it comes to genius. I mean, that's the point I'm making. But actually, I think whilst correlation does not imply causation, I think the very important thing that they did not teach us in first year statistics is that it also does not preclude it. If you observe a correlation in the data, it may well be causal. So the fact that it doesn't imply correlation shouldn't lead you to the conclusion that there is no causal relationship. That's a different question and something that you have to prove out of the data. So let's talk about this, and let's talk about physical activity. So obviously we have a lot of data on that. The traditional approach to look at this is to say, let's throw all the data into a model, all the data that we could possibly put together, whatever it is, the plan that people are on, chronic status, their chronicity, whether they're smoking or not, and then we add physical activity to that. We run it through a model and say, does this new data item that we have, which is the number of times that you exercise, the intensity with which you exercise, does it actually make a difference to the outcome variable that would be predicted claims, whether it's mortality or morbidity, whatever the case may be. The problem with this approach is that it does give you an answer and tells you whether physical activity is important in avoiding claims, but it doesn't give you the full answer. It just tells you that fact. So because what it quantifies is the marginal effect of physical activity given everything else. So you add it now to a model that doesn't have it in and that just quantifies what's the difference by adding it. And what that means is that if you only look at that, you develop your strategy on the basis of that marginal effect, not the full effect. And that's both different, and it would lead to different decisions when you think about physical activity. So the way that data science is done traditionally is to say there's a probability of death, for argument's sake, given a level of exercise. The key thing is that if you want to make an intervention and encourage people to exercise more, the model on the left doesn't really give you the answer, because the question that you have to ask is, what's the probability of death given a change in exercise? Because we're now incentivizing people to exercise, and some of them don't respond to it, but some of them do, and they exercise in a different way. And the way that one needs to quantify that is an entirely different way. Can't use the traditional approach because it won't give you the answer. It will just give you the marginal effect of exercise with all the other factors being static, including exercise. So we need to understand the impact of a change in exercise given all the other variables that we have. Just a lot of variables, but you know, you can imagine that age and chronicity and blood pressure and BMI, all of those things are part of it. So the way to think about it first is that there are confounding factors, right? And the first one is chronicity, for instance. So if somebody suffers from multiple chronic diseases already, and if they exercise, The fact that they are unhealthy will impact how much change they have in exercise in the first place and whether they exercise. It will also affect their mortality by itself in the same way that exercise does. So you need to, or not in the same way, in the opposite way. So you need to understand and be able to untangle those effects. So you have to adjust for all the confounding factors. It's not only chronicity which is a confounding factor. There could be several others in the data, and one needs to understand that so that you can then compare apples with apples. People with similar levels of chronicity compared against people with similar levels of chronicity. But that's only the first step. The second thing is to say, does exercise also affect the other variables? So a change in exercise, if you do it, you would probably lose some weight. So it would lead to a change in BMI. That in itself has an impact on your mortality outcome. It also has a direct effect on mortality, and it also has an effect on your blood pressure, and your probability of having high blood pressure, and it changes that. And all of those things have an impact on mortality. So the question is not just what is the marginal effect of exercise or a change in exercise. You have to add all of these elements together to get the full impact. So you have to make sure that the mediators are adjusted for. The third thing that you have to do is to adjust for covariates. So as we know, everybody, not many people in the room might know that, but as you grow older, you tend to exercise less. Okay, as when you get to your 50s, you'll understand what I'm saying. But that's consistent across all of the data, and it's obvious. By the time that you're 95, you're not going to, it would be highly unusual that you still run a marathon, right? So you have to adjust for that as well. That's the covariate that you have to adjust for. Now, the key thing to doing this is basically not to try and look at the data from the bottom up and say, I'm going to quantify all the mediators, verify the mediators, look at the covariates, adjust for the confounders. You have to actually make an upfront decision on what the structure of the model would be and what makes sense, and then you prove from the data whether that's the case or not. So you first set up a hypothesis in a model saying these are the confounders, these are the mediators, and these are the covariates, and then you look at the data to see does it support that hypothesis that you put on the table for the model. And that's called causal inference. So this is how it works. From research that you've done, even just from your understanding of the world, you have an inherent understanding of what you're looking at and what factors are important in a model such as this, and you want to understand the overall treatment effect. So first thing that we do is that we impose a structure, then we control for the known set of confounders. The tools will tell you if there are others that it picks up, or it will become obvious through the modeling if there are other confounders that have not been picked up by the model or that you didn't put in your hypothesis. And then depending on the structure of the data, so whether you're looking at a continuous variable, at a binary variable, or a categorical variable, depending on that, you would use different causal inference models. So the ones that we've tested are structural equation modeling, Bayesian networks, causal forests, and matching. All of them follow this methodology that you have an initial structure that you believe applies to the world, and then you use the data and the tool to verify that. And depending on which one on what your variables look like, there are different tools that would give you the best answer and would help you to understand exactly how causality operates within the data. For some of them, you have to do additional transformation, like to, you know, for instance, discretize the covariates. You can't have a continuous variable in there. But effectively, you know, no matter what the problem is, if you have enough data, you would be able then to support or basically deny what the hypothesis states. Now, we've started to do this across the board. Many of the work that we're doing, for instance, during COVID, we wanted to say, during COVID, if people exercise, what's the impact of that on their likelihood of being admitted to hospital if they test positive for COVID? And we use causal inference to give that answer. And that helped us not only to say that obviously we must encourage people to exercise, but also to say that those that don't are certainly at higher risk. That means that they should get pulse oximeters, and if they do, we can hopefully help them to avoid the worst outcomes with COVID. Causal inference helped us to understand that. When we look at it now in the UK, for instance, in particular, we have lots of vitality benefits and it changes all the time. We understand exactly what benefit will give what selection effect, what behavior change effect, what retention effect, and to what extent, if it's added to a portfolio of benefits, It's almost like a dashboard. If you increase the coffee benefit and reduce the cinema benefit, this is what the impact would be on lapses and on new business and on behavior change. And that helps us then, obviously, to populate that program in a far more detail and to make the decisions on what to introduce and what to take away in a consistent basis. And it's very powerful once you have that framework in place. So how does it work in practice? So the first thing that you do is you start with a causal inference model. As we said, you try to understand all of these impacts. You adjust for confounding mediation effects and for covariates. Then what you do is you quantify the change in the outcome given a change in the particular thing that you're looking at. So, for instance, physical activity. So given a change in exercise, what would be the outcome either on the severity or the frequency of claims or on death? Then what you do is you say, what is the client's propensity for different physical activities and for taking up the rewards? Now, again, we understand that from the data because we have all of these rewards basically on offer to people. And we understand quite a lot about clients' incentives, their response to incentives. So some people are maximizers. You can give them R5, or if you offer them R5, they would run a marathon for it. Other people like me, you need to give me a painting before I run a marathon for it. So people are different, and if you understand just how they behave relative to the incentives, you can get a good sense of what that propensity is. But then what we have is a universe of possible outcomes, given that propensity and given how likely they are to engage in activity. That depends also on how sick or healthy they are. Once you have that, in other words, a universe of possible outcomes linked to a matrix of actions for every individual member that we have data for. And this is not only for existing members. If you understand who's coming into the data, in other words, new policyholders, it gets populated for them already. So we understand how likely they are to engage in activity. I can tell you, for instance, in London, it's very important where you live. So if you live close to a park, you're far more likely to be physically active than if you don't. And there's a variety of reasons for that. It also happens to be that wealthy people live close to parks. So you have to understand how income is a confounding factor to that propensity to be active. But you then have that for every single individual member, which means that we can identify what's the optimal outcome. So what is most realistically the optimal way that somebody should be exercising? And we can compare that to how they're exercising right now. And there's a gap between the two. However, if you understand this optimal outcome and the causal impact that it would have, and because you understand how that will reduce that person's mortality in the context of having sold a life insurance policy for them to them, you can say basically this is how much value it would have for us if they were to exercise, which means that you can decide how much benefits to give to them to encourage exercise. And this is really what it's moving towards in much of our thinking in lots of our markets across the world, to be able to tell that and to be able to say from the data effectively what are the causal effects that we're modeling, but also what can we do to change that. It doesn't apply only to physical activity. It also applies to how you navigate the healthcare system. It also applies to how you market, how you sell, how you price policies, all of that. And what is interesting about the post-COVID era is that everything has changed in terms of how people access healthcare. So in the UK, for instance, one example, I was very worried when we introduced the online cognitive behavioral therapy first. We gave a benefit for that, and I was worried about utilization and the cost that it would have. But we did it, and we did it just before COVID. So what we saw during COVID is that actually the utilization of that went through the roof. There's a lot of people that wanted therapy and that went online for it for the first time. What we see now when we look back is that our admission rate for mental health has come down dramatically. So it's one of the first instances and one of the major instances that I've seen of actually a mental health benefit having a real impact. The end result of that is that we have 2.5 times the people accessing mental health care from before, but the cost has remained the same. And that's a fantastic outcome, not only for us, but obviously for them as well. And I think that gives you the opportunity then to say, can you now make the links, given that we have this data of all the people going for cognitive behavioral therapy, and can we say then that we should recommend to people whether they should go for this therapy or not? And the answer is yes, if you have the data. So we apply this in all of our parts of the value chain, whether it's the way that we attract customers, the way that we service them, the way that we price our premiums. So in the UK, obviously, we can vary the premium for people with different risk profiles, and we do. And the premium can go up and down. It's similar to, for instance, airline pricing here. It's not a single premium for everybody. And the way that we optimize that is crucially dependent on the data that we have and how quickly we have the data available, both for new business and renewal pricing. Then, obviously, as we discuss how we change their behavior, again, all of the modeling underlying that is crucial, both in terms of predicting how they are likely to behave, how they should behave, and then how we close that gap between how they should behave and what they actually do with incentives, with understanding the value of it, and then determining what the intervention should be, and obviously on retention as well, applying these tools in practice. So for each of these elements of the value chain, the models are in operation in the background. Most of them are AI type of models. Lots of them are integrated in the system already. So in other words, the machines make the decisions on how a premium should be priced when somebody comes to our website to take out a policy. And that's what you have to set up in order to take advantage of all of this when it comes to affecting the ways that people behave and the way that they interact with us. So I think when you think about new generation data science in healthcare, there are amazing opportunities if you were to construct data in such a way and to use it in such a way to intervene and to really affect people's health, to give them benefits that they might not otherwise have had access to, and to encourage them to lead healthier lifestyles. I think what's important for us is to move away from the mindset of looking what happened in the past and then expressing a valuation on that, to say, this is how much this policy is worth, or this is where the medical scheme's value lies, or this is its solvency, or whatever the question is. That's certainly, all of those questions are important. The more important question to me is, what could it be? And what could we do to affect that value, both at individual level, but also at a systemic level? And what are the best interventions that we can take then to get there? And I think if you understand causality, and if you do so at individual level, it gives you the tools to be able to do that in practice. So I thought I'd end off with two questions to the audience. And I would really like to understand your view on this. What do you think is more important? The data itself, the data science tools, or the platform in which you host the data? I'd like to have a sort of vote by hand. Am I allowed to, Sheldon? So who would vote for number one? And for number two? Okay. And three? One at the back. So if I was setting the exam, I would have said, which one of the following is the least likely not to be true? A or C, or one or two, one and three. But I think, in my view, I think you got it right. It's the data. If you don't have the data, no matter how fancy your tools, your platform, you can't actually use it. And I think we really need to think about where we get the data from. There's a lot more data generated now than in the past. There's a lot more wearable devices, even devices used in hospital that generate a lot of data. How do we get access to the data so that we're in a position to compare patients against each other and then to have an impact on their healthcare? So through COVID also, obviously, data was very important to understand who's vaccinated, who got COVID, did they test positive or negative, when all of that became really important. In addition to that, obviously, what affected their risk. And it was very valuable to have the data available to do so. But the data itself is the most important thing. So the question then is, who is more important? Second question. Actuaries. data scientists or data engineers? So who votes for number one, actuaries? Nobody. This is a historic moment. There's one vote for actuaries. Who thinks that data scientists are the most important? Nobody. Data engineers? Three people. Most of you don't have a clue who's the most important. At the moment, data engineers by far are the most important, right? To be able to handle this data and to set up the platform that you need to use the data in practice really needs data engineering. And why they're the most important is because you just can't find them. There's a worldwide shortage in data engineers. It's a very specific skill, and everybody's fighting for their time, effectively. So not long from now, data engineers will be paid far more than actuaries. That's my prediction. We're already seeing it happening. And I think the reason is that you need to have lots of data, and you have to have it accessible to your models. And if you don't have that, then the actuaries can't do their jobs. To give you a sense of that, in the UK, where all of our life insurance is sold on broker portals, we currently do 13 million quotes per month on those portals. Now, with that volume of data, all of it has to happen within less than a second, far less than a second for it to even appear on the portal. With all of that data, you can imagine that if you just tweak something slightly, it could have a big impact on your new business volumes, quality of new business, all of that. And that's really the world that we're moving towards. South Africa is not quite there when it comes to life insurance selling, but it will eventually get there. And I think the important thing is to develop the data assets right now to be ready for that. So I hope you found that interesting. Thank you very much for the time. And I think we now have some time for questions.
Thank you, Emu.
Thanks, Shelton.
So, the online participants, your first question, they were Nadine answered two. Mm-hmm. And who's most important? I thought that was a rhetoric question. They answered one. And I'm sure everyone in the room believes though. So, my question, comment.
Yeah.
I actually think actuaries can be data engineers if they so wish. And we'll probably do a good job.
Because they can, but they should do a lot of training before they try.
So. Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of dedication. Some of the terms that I heard you talk about, I didn't hear them from my statistics class. Correlation, yes. Causation, probably not. Mediation, confounding, effect modifiers. I think we're actually upskilling and getting there, and we'll probably have a big say in terms of data science. So there's a question here, mm-hmm. and I'm so glad someone asked it because I didn't want to be the one to ask it. Mm-hmm. So Berry Childs is asking, I have a question for Emil, but have to put it here. How do you get over the big brother fear? Fear of people, that people are watching over them.
Sure.
You have so much data on them, or even manipulating them. It even gets in the territory of, we know what's better than what's good for you. So we know what's better for, I'll just rephrase, you almost insinuate that we know what's better for you and what's good for you. So I think it's an important question.
It is a very important question. So let me take that. I think there are a few elements to it. The first thing is how you use the data. So, for instance, do you use all of the knowledge that you have? The answer to that is an emphatic no. There's a lot that you can pick up out of the data that you would not use in pricing, for argument's sake, even in underwriting, and particularly, for instance, if you don't have the permission to do that. So, obviously, one has to have the permission to use data, but that's not enough. I think that's just the first step. The second step is then, what is the ethics of how you apply the data in practice? So what we've had to develop over the years is really a bit of a detailed ethics framework. It's very different from saying what's a legal framework. That sort of tick the box to say that that's something that you should do in any event to make sure that you have the permissions. But the ethics framework on how we use the data. Now, the purpose for which we use the data is critical in that. So if we use it, for instance, to make people healthier, so if, for instance, we use exercise data to determine that you are at very high risk of being admitted to COVID if you test positive because of your lack of exercise, your BMI, and then we give you a pulse oximeter as soon as you test positive, that to me is something that our clients would accept and, in fact, expect us to do if we have that knowledge. If we say nothing about it, then they would be upset about it if we could have saved lives. And we've proven that that in itself saved a lot of lives. What we won't do is to say that if you suffer from particular conditions, we'll charge you more on your car insurance premium. Okay? Because we believe that that's not something that we have permission for, or in fact the ethics to apply within the environment. So you really do have to think about that and to make sure, and to have a lot of ethical debate about how you use the data. The second point, which is very important, is transparency. Okay, so people need to understand what data we have about them. And the way that we think about that is to actually try and tell you all the time what information we have about you. So I had this debate with a journalist, and she was frustrated in the conversation and said, but you know that I went for a run this morning. So I said, yes, but how do we know that? It's because you told us you went for a run. Then we told you that you told us that you went for a run. You can see it on your app, and we said, here's a coffee for you because you went for a run. And then you went to get the coffee on the app, and we said, well done. It's very transparent, right? So if you don't have to tell us that you went for a run. If you do, you can get your coffee. And if you choose to do that, then obviously you understand that that data is part of what we're looking at. And that transparency, I think, is very important as well. I think, though, that there are instances where you would use data against people's interests. And the only thing that I can think of, the only one that we've come across so far, is in the context of fraud. So if you have somebody who deliberately wants to commit fraud against a medical scheme, the way that we think about it is that we can use any and all data to verify whether that is the case or not. So if they committed fraud in whatever way, claim for something that is not really medical treatment, and we have another way to figure that out from the rest of our data, we will use that to catch the fraud. But that's the only instance that I can think of where we're using this data in somebody's disadvantage. I think there is also an ethical question that is very important, which is that if you have the data but you don't use it, whether that is ethical. And my view is that it's not. If we can tell that there's a high rate of hospital-acquired infections in a particular hospital, it feels to me as if we have to act on that, and we have to tell people, firstly the hospital, and eventually the regulators, eventually the members, if they don't react to that. And I think that's also part of our ethical framework. So I hope that answers the question. It's hard, obviously, to be specific about it, but I think everybody that has access to data needs to think very carefully about these issues.
I'm answered to a big extent. I hope Barry is. And trust is everything. We have to trust you with the data. Yeah. And we certainly hope it will always be used in our best interests. I think this is a question which obviously does not apply to data science only. We are also being checked and monitored, social media, a lot of things. And I think the ethics around it is key. I'm trying to get more questions from the online. It seems there is none. We'll move on to the floor.
Thanks, Emil. Given the focus on the data and the large volume of the data, how does one take this if you're a smaller player in the market that doesn't necessarily have that much data? How do you answer these questions, or how do you move into this next generation without the vast volume of data of a discovery?
It's a good question. Obviously, in South Africa, discovery is big, but it's not big in the 37 countries that we're in. So in some of our smaller markets, that is a crucial question. I guess one of the advantages that we have is the sort of insight and know-how, what to look for in the data and to try and obtain the data in whatever market we are. But to give you a sense, in the UK, we 12% of the market, of the PMI market, which is only, it's less than half of the people in the UK have that. So, and we don't get access to all of the medical claims there. So again, you have to then use whatever you have available and to use that in the models. And that's where quality of fit becomes important. So if the model is not populated with enough longitudinal data, it's very hard, if not impossible, to get some sense of causality out of that. Then you have to collect more data, wait more time until you have that. Or alternatively, just go with your gut feel. So when Vitality was launched, there was no data to say that exercise would reduce claims, but it was based on a sort of leap of faith at that time. So there is that you have to lean more towards a leap of faith if you don't have the data to support it. But I think the important thing is again, in terms of our mindset, not to think that we don't have the data so we can't do anything. There's a lot of stuff that you can do just from common sense and then build up the data by doing exactly that. But yeah, I think that's probably the best way to think about it.
Thank you, Emil. Sure. I'm glad you have a bit of hair, so I do trust there was a bit of genius left while you're presenting to us. So we can move on to the next session.
Thank you. And I'll say cheers. Thanks very much, everybody.